This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is Mark Zuckerberg, CEO of Meta, a.k.a. Facebook, back in 2016 at the Global Entrepreneurship Summit.
You know, the most effective entrepreneurs that who I've met care deeply about some mission and some change that they're trying to create, right? And, you know, that's how I think about, you know, my connection to all of us here is, you know, I was getting started. I care deeply about giving everyone a voice, right, and giving people the tools to share everything that they cared about and bringing a community together. And, you know, it started small in one university. You know, you keep going because you care, not because you're trying to create a business.
Well, I mean, Mark Zuckerberg, come on, let's be honest. He cared so much about connecting people that the very first social site he ever created in that small dorm room was FaceMash, a Hot or Not ripoff where he scraped, read, hacked, photos of female undergraduates from Harvard's online directory so people could rank who was hotter. That didn't last long, obviously. But then Zuckerberg did indeed start the Facebook, an idea he arguably stole from other Harvard students and ended up settling in a subsequent lawsuit brought by those folks for $65 million. But I am getting distracted by the facts. Sorry, that happens sometimes when listening to Mark Zuckerberg, but today's focus is actually on the ethos of what Zuckerberg is saying about Facebook's messianic mission.
Connecting everyone.
No, seriously, if you think about, I mean, it's like this aesthetic sense of the world that I have is that you can, communities of people can channel their energy to do great things, and having connections between people is the infrastructure for the world to do that.
You see, in Silicon Valley, the thinking is often you're doing something much, much bigger than just starting a company. You're breaking the surly bonds of quotidian concern and making a whole new world. Now, to be fair, Zuckerberg did that with Facebook. He really did reshape the world in many ways. But here's a question. Doesn't this all sound just a little bit like corporatism as religion? And the language is pretty familiar to most of us now. There's talk about creating a life that matters, about capturing your purpose and passion. You remember that famous book, The Purpose-Driven Life, by Pastor Rick Warren? Well, in Silicon Valley, it's that same talk of purpose, but then add leveraging this powerful tool to create the business and future of your dreams. Now, it may not be that surprising that a billionaire tech titan talks about his own exploits in such messianic terms, but the belief trickles down. It shapes the corporate culture and therefore the lives of tens of thousands of workers. So what's the impact of that when work becomes religion? That's the focus of Carolyn Chen's new book. The book is called Work, Pray, Code: When Work Becomes Religion in Silicon Valley. And Carolyn Chen is a sociologist and a professor of ethnic studies at the University of California, Berkeley, and she joins us today from Berkeley, California. Professor Chen, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Meghna.
I should say more specifically, you're actually a scholar of religion. So I want to first start by asking you, how would you just define what a religion is?
Well, you know, that's a great question, and it's one that often scholars of religion shy away from because it can be so many things. The way that I like to look at religion is by looking at its function and by looking at what it does in society. And that's my particular approach as a sociologist of religion. So when we think about how religion functions in American society, what it does for people is that historically religion has fulfilled the needs for identity, belonging, community, meaning, purpose, and transcendence for Americans. And it has been through their faith communities that they've gotten those needs met. And what I'm arguing in my book is that this is now the company is where tech workers get those needs met now in Silicon Valley. And so in my book, I call companies the new faith communities. in Silicon Valley.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I want to let people know that I'm going to ask you a bit later, Professor Chen, how much we can extrapolate to work life outside of Silicon Valley. But it makes perfect sense to me that given that you're in Berkeley, you wouldn't look far from home to see what the effects of a kind of religious sentiment would be if it indeed was creeping into the workplace. But I do have to ask you, though, it doesn't seem to me that work would be a natural place for you to look. Right. So how did you tell me about the path that you took that made you think I work might be the exact location that I need to examine to understand religiosity in America today?
Yeah, that's such a great question, Meghna. As a scholar of religion, I'm used to studying religious things. So that's people, institutions, community, text practices that identify explicitly with a formal religious tradition. But I think that for most Americans who live in coastal metropolitan areas know that religious affiliation and religious participation are on the decline. And so and actually the fastest growing religious group are those who don't affiliate with religion at all. And so the question for me as a sociologist of religion is how do I understand sociologists call them the religious nones, N-O-N-E-S, and how do we study the effects of religion in this secular age? And so I first started this project actually by looking at yoga practitioners and yoga studios. These are spaces which are secular, and yet they have, you know, religious icons, religious practices in them. And so I first started this practice, my study by interviewing and yoga practitioners. And what I found was, you know, I would ask them, so why do you practice yoga? When do you practice yoga? How do you practice yoga? Again, getting back to this question of, you know, how do people use their religious practices? And they would tell me, well, I practice yoga after a long day of work to help me stretch, to relax, to de-stress. And also, practicing yoga makes me a better ex. And here you can fill in the blank. It might be a nurse, it might be an engineer, it might be a doctor or a lawyer. But central in these narratives was this story of how yoga was very important to essentially their work. And they would tell me stories about how they would sacrifice, you know, their family relationships, their wellness, their bodies, their time for work. And it became clear to me that what was really sacred in their lives, what was sacred wasn't really yoga practice. And instead, what was sacred in their lives was work. Mm-hmm. They were willing to submit, surrender, and sacrifice their bodies, their families, their relationships for work. And instead, yoga, which is what I had thought, well, maybe this is a quasi-spiritual religious practice, was merely ancillary. It was a therapeutic practice to help them work better. So it was really that work was what was the center of their lives and what their practices revolved around. So this was kind of a shift for me. And so I was thinking, wait, I think I'm looking in the wrong place. You know, I was thinking about what was sacred was that which is attached to a religious or spiritual tradition. No, in fact, what was sacred was their work. And so that's what led me to looking at the workplace.
Okay. So in your book, Work, Pray, Code, you write about what you learned over, 5 years of examining and talking to people all across Silicon Valley, more than 100 or so interviews. So first of all, tell me, what was some of the commonalities of what people told you about how they view their work that made you think it did have a sacred sense to it, to those folks?
Yeah, so a few things here. For almost everyone that I spoke to, work gave them a very strong sense of identity. And I would argue that this was their primary sense of identity, was from their work. Many people talked about their work using very spiritual language, as having a sense of calling and mission, exactly how, you know, Mark Zuckerberg was talking about it in the earlier part of the show. And for many people, essentially their whole lives revolved around the workplace. This is where they got their sense of belonging. For people who worked very intensely, you know, they would spend, 60, 70, 80 hours working. Essentially, their closest friends were all at the workplace. And because, I conducted my research before the pandemic. So at that time, there was a lot of, you know, their lives revolved around the workplace. And they also, these companies would provide their meals. They would provide their social activities. So they would have these clubs, their hobbies. HR would organize theater tickets, you know. They also worked out there. And the companies also provided mindfulness, meditation, spiritual care as well. So their lives revolved around the institution of the workplace. And this is where they got their sense of community, belonging, identity, and also meaning and purpose. People would often talk to me about drinking the Kool-Aid. They had this, they understood that really, in order to belong, in order to produce at that high level, they needed to, quote unquote, drink the Kool-Aid. There was this element of faith in what they were doing.
Now, honestly, some of the things that you described about Silicon Valley corporate culture are exactly the things that make people quite jealous about Silicon Valley, to be honest.
I know.
To have a sense of purpose, to have actually a lot of services then provided for you, because that's actually part of the labor exchange. We're going to ask you to work 80, 90 hours a week, but we're going to make your life a little easier in return. But I think what you're getting at, and we'll pick it up after the break, is that what happens when that same sense of purpose and community isn't found or experienced by those same workers outside of work. So, Carolyn Chen, stand by for just a moment. We're talking about Professor Chen's new book, Work, Pray, Code: When Work Becomes Religion in Silicon Valley. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and Professor Carolyn Chen joins us today. She's a professor of sociology and ethnic studies at the University of California, Berkeley. She really focuses on sociology and religion. And she's the author of a fascinating new book called Work, Pray, Code: When Work Becomes Religion in Silicon Valley. And we've got an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. Now, Professor Chen, you use some really interesting language when describing how not all Americans, but I think probably, call them the professional classes in America, view work. You talk about work having become the alpha institution, and therefore that creating this theocracy of work. I wonder if you have an example of that from an individual that you interviewed for the book. How did that sort of theocratic view of work play into the lives of some of the people you met?
Yeah, I'll tell you a story of one person that I interviewed who was very memorable, and his name is John Ashton. He's a tech entrepreneur who moved from Georgia to Silicon Valley to join a startup, and one of the things that's so interesting with him is that he, when he lived in Georgia, he was an evangelical Christian, quite a fervent evangelical Christian who was very involved in his church. He was even the president of his Christian fraternity. And that when he came, when he moved to Silicon Valley, he essentially gave up his religion for several reasons. First, the work hours of his startup were so demanding that he had no time to socialize, to join, to do anything outside of the workplace. But work also had that, again, this faith community element to it, where he ate three meals at work. All of his friends came from the workplace, whereas before it had been his church where he, you know, played in a band, he did all of his social activities, he went camping with them. Now it simply became replaced by the folks in his workplace. He also had this really strong sense, the sense of mission that he had before that his faith gave him. It was now provided to him by his startup. And he kept on talking to me. When he spoke to me about his sense of mission, he kept on using this Christian language, this Christian missionary language. Like, we have this burden, you know. And to me, he would say over and over, we have this burden to change the world. We have this burden to change the world, to talk about the mission of his company. And there was also this element of faith in his job, where because in Silicon Valley, the vast majority of startups fail, 9 out of 10 startups fail, you know, only 1 out of 10 actually make it. They either get acquired or they IPO. So there is always that element of faith in what he was doing. I'm working really hard. I'm devoting, I'm sacrificing my entire life because I have this belief that we're going to be this 1 in 10 to succeed. And so I call it the theocracy of work, because a theocracy is a system, right? It's not just a personal someone who's believing in this one thing, but rather it's a social system. And that's what I think is happening in Silicon Valley, where essentially the workplace has replaced has replaced the functions of religious institutions. And they have essentially they act like this giant magnet that attracts all the time, energy, and devotion of a community, so that people's entire lives revolve around the work. But as a result of that, other social institutions grow weaker and smaller. So these are these other magnets, right, that are trying to attract the time and energy and devotion of a community. Instead, what happens is that because essentially the company monopolizes all of that, all the other social institutions, so these are families, these are faith communities, neighborhood associations, you know, even small businesses, in order to attract the time, energy, and devotion of the community, they have to end up coming to service the workplace. And I call this a techtopia, essentially a place, a society where work becomes the highest form of fulfillment.
Yeah. I mean, ironically, it sounds like a libertarian church, which is a phrase, two phrases, you know, like in because there's, well, I'll come back to that in a second. But we have a little bit of tape here from a woman named Jessica Dye, who works in Silicon Valley. And she describes exactly what you're talking about here. She's at a startup that works on machine learning. And here's what she says.
All of your needs are taken care of. You don't really need to think about who is taking care of them for you. The stereotype is like, you leave your house in San Francisco, the Google bus like comes and picks you up, drives past like a street full of people who are unhoused, drops you off in front of your Google building, you eat breakfast, lunch, dinner there, and then like you get on the bus and it takes you back and you like never interact with the outside world. That's a bit extreme. But yeah, I do think there is this sort of sense that if you're getting all of your social interaction from work, like why would you care about the world around you?
Professor Chen, can you remark on that? Because it's not just that all of Jessica's time is being taken up by work. She even talks about sort of a mental shift, about being mentally disconnected from the world outside of her work.
Right, right. Absolutely. I mean, I think that what ends up happening is that work kind of becomes a bubble, right? And it insulates you from the rest of the world, from the public, because essentially you don't need it anymore. If you're taking the Google bus, you're not taking public transportation, which means that you're not invested in supporting the public infrastructure for a good public transportation system. You're not invested in, and so this is what I found in my work, is that work in a sense, I mean, and here let me just go back to what I, you know, when I talk about the theocracy of work, when I talk about kind of religion becoming, work becoming religion, is that we often talk about work as being extractive, right? That work is like taking our time, it's sucking our soul, it's sucking our energy from us, right? That's sort of the conventional way that we talk about work. But I really think that what I argue in my book is that in the last 40, 50 years, that there's really been a shift in the way that work, we interact with work, particularly among high, and I should say, this is limited to high-skilled professionals, and particularly in what I call knowledge industry hubs like Silicon Valley or like Cambridge, Los Angeles, and New York, okay? And that what's happening is that work has shifted from becoming extractive to actually becoming attractive, to becoming a source of fulfillment, right? It's fulfilling us in these social, spiritual, and of course, material ways. And so that we become attracted to work, and so that we need to start shifting the way that we talk about work. And once we need to understand how actually work really fulfills so many of our fundamental, you know, of our fundamental needs for, you know, our social, spiritual, and material needs. Go ahead.
Can I just jump in here for a second? Because you've really touched on something there that that resonates quite intensely with me. I have so many questions, Professor.
Yes, go.
When you say about this this change in sort of the view of work over the past 40 and 50 years for knowledge workers in particular, which is an important distinction, right? Because there are many, many working Americans who know clearly that perhaps they're not going to go to work to find purpose, but to find, you know, income to support their families. And I want to just make that clear. But for the types of workers you're talking about, that 40 to 50 year time period fascinates me because, full disclosure, it captures the, you know, the duration of my life so far. And and part of the reason, just reflecting on my own growing up and the, you know, what I know from my peers and friends, is that you're talking about a couple of generations of people who were told from the beginning by family, in school especially, seek your purpose in what you do. Find a mission in life. And it wasn't, you know, it was a sort of a secular call for that, right? Because in public schools, they're not going to say go to church to find that mission. But they'll, you know, I remember hearing over and over and over again from all sorts of people, family, teachers, community, you know, like, you will find fulfillment when you find your purpose and find your passion, and work shall, you know, find a job that fulfills that passion. So it makes perfect sense that we may have ended up in that place. And I just want to ask you, first of all, so what's wrong with that?
Yeah, I think that that's a great question. And many people have asked me about that. I think that, first of all, you know, I wouldn't want anyone to read my book and think that, oh, she wants everyone to have an awful job and to be unhappy at work. I think that we need to understand, I think that, you know, what we've seen in the last 40, 50 years is really this bifurcation, really, where, you know, there are some people, as you mentioned, high-skilled professionals who are having very fulfilling work lives and are working, spending many hours at work, right? And then you have now this contingent labor force that is, can't find enough work, actually, and has unstable pay and insecure jobs. So just, you know, just to lay that out and to be clear. But I think that when you ask what's wrong with that is, like, first of all, we need to understand that work is an important source of dignity. It is an important source of meaning and purpose for people. And this is not just in the last 40 years or in 20th century capitalism. I mean, this has always been the case. I think that here what is the problem is that when it becomes the only thing that's providing your identity, belonging, meaning, and purpose. And so I think to understand this and to kind of understand how there might be different models for doing this, we might go back to the 50s and 60s in America when you have really the emergence and the rise of a white-collar workforce. And during that time in the 50s and 60s, white-collar workers were pretty much working 9 to 5. They were working 40 hours a week. And they were building, and they had a sense that this was work, and they were building their lives outside of work in a very robust civic society and civic culture. This was in their Rotary clubs. This was in their bowling leagues. These were in their neighborhood associations. These were in their faith communities. Well, what we've seen in the last, 50 years is this big decline in civic participation. Mm-hmm. And this is and we can really and we see this quite acute. Well, we see this quite acutely with religious participation and religious affiliation, as I was talking about earlier. And so what's wrong is so that at a time in the 1950s and 60s, yes, people were finding meaning and purpose and identity in work, but they also had other sources of meaning and belonging and purpose, right? And that what we find today with the impoverishment of our civil society, with the weakening of our civic institutions, that work has instead colonized many of these other functions and these other institutions. And, and I would argue that in places like Silicon Valley, it's become the last meaningful institution standing. And it actually provides the most efficient solution to living a meaningful life. When you can join a company and they tell you, these companies have an army of organizational psychologists, experts, essentially professionals who are there to make you happy. When I interviewed HR professionals, they would tell me things like, when I would ask them, well, tell me what you do. What is your purpose here in this company? They would tell me things like, well, it's to nurture the souls of the employees. They would use that kind of language to care for them, to bring wholeness to their lives. Well, who wouldn't want that? Mm. What I found was that I don't think there's any social institution that is more committed to the fulfillment, to your fulfillment than a tech company is to their tech workers. Yeah. And that's a problem when our lives become defined by our companies and by our labor, because we are more than our labor.
Right. Right. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. And so Carolyn Chen, what you're saying is so fascinating, because when work becomes sort of the last meaningful institution standing, the problem is that work is not church. It's not temple. It's not, a civic organization that brings people together for reasons beyond financial transactions. Because ultimately, work is still work. There's a transactional nature to it. And so you've also talked to people about, in your book, about what happens when that job ends or something goes wrong in that job, or the reality of capitalism sets in. What does it do to the souls of the people that were supposedly being nurtured by that very corporation?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I remember interviewing one woman who was a tech entrepreneur and who had really, her story was really no different from so many of the people that I interviewed. Her whole life started to revolve around the startup. She ate all of her meals there. All of her, social circle was the company. And there was this promise for her that, after sacrificing her whole life, her sacrificing for the company, that it would get acquired. And when that acquisition fell through, she was completely devastated. And she really went through this existential crisis, which she described to me as a death to self. She said that she just didn't know who she was anymore. She had no meaning and purpose anymore in her life. And she talked about how her work had provided so much of her sense of self and her sense of identity that she told me that she couldn't even make simple choices like what to eat in the morning. She didn't even know, because previously all those things had just simply been provided for her and essentially curated. I mean, you have to think about these companies as really curating your experience and your reality. In fact, many of the HR people that I would talk to would talk about work as an experience, right? And so there was this complete loss of self when she left the company, and that was devastating for her.
Well, Carolyn Chen's book is Work, Pray, Code: When Work Becomes Religion in Silicon Valley. And we're also looking more broadly, not just in the Bay Area, but across the United States, about the expectations people have of work in terms of the kinds of fulfillment it can and should provide and what it can't do. So we'll have a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and Carolyn Chen joins us today. She's a professor of sociology at the University of California, Berkeley, and she's out with this fascinating new book called Work, Pray, Code: When Work Becomes Religion in Silicon Valley. And of course, we're also looking beyond Silicon Valley as well, about the spiritual connection or expectations people might have from their work or experience from their work in this day and age. And we asked you, On Point listeners, to reflect on that. And we got a lot of calls from you. So here's a few.
And although the work can be very difficult at times, it is very fulfilling being able to give back to others as part of my job.
I'm a teacher, and I actually changed careers from working in international business in a corporate setting to becoming a teacher because I wanted those 40 plus hours to go towards making a difference in my community and in the world.
Like most religious people I know, I have long understood that work has a way of crowding out the other important aspects of life, such as family, friends, community involvement, and of course, religion. So I think it's only with years of experience and reflection that we come to understand how one-dimensional and incomplete the workplace life is.
Our vocation might help create community, but it cannot replace community. It might help contribute to our sense of givingness, but it cannot replace our own spiritual practice.
I'm a rancher. Do I seek or find transcendence or spiritual connection or community through work? I would say yes. I find connection with people in my community and people that are ranchers here locally, even though I disagree with some of these people on their political views and stuff like that. I still agree in the core values that we have. And I find that being connected with the land and being connected with livestock and horses and cattle and growing things, I feel like that's a connection to my community and a connection to the past as well.
So you just heard Rick from Oklahoma, Milton from New Mexico, Hillary in Ohio, Laura in Washington, and Jennifer in Kentucky. Just a few of the many calls we got about people's thoughts about spirituality, transcendence, and connection in work. Now, Professor Chen, if you can just hang on for another few minutes here, I want to bring Lauren Padron into the conversation. She is a mechanical engineer and also a student at Florida International University, and she joins us from Miami. Lauren, welcome to On Point.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Now, you had called us as well and left a really fascinating message about your view of finding connection and transcendence in work. And I wanted to bring you on live in the conversation, specifically because you're also an engineer. And a lot of the folks we're talking about on the other coast in Silicon Valley are engineers as well. So as a mechanical engineer, Lauren, how do you find purpose or meaning in your work?
Hi, yes. So my work includes field work out in the Everglades. I do active dives for surveying, essentially our resources. I also do technical work in terms of understanding our wastewater and how we are disposing this water and how it's going back to the fish and back to the anglers that work out there and back to the community. So I also work in a nanoplastics lab. I just started that project, and I hope to give back to my community by creating more devices that are able to solve these issues. And I guess I'm a little bit of an outlier because I was raised atheist. I am currently agnostic, and I find spirituality in the world around me and understanding the world, in feeling like I'm alive and I'm able to comprehend as little as I can, right, about the environment around me. I think that in and of itself leaves me awestruck. And that awe is really my sense of spirituality, because I feel it at very specific moments in a very intense way.
Yeah. And so did that the emergence of that awe come because of the work that you're doing? Because I hear, I mean, like diving in the Everglades and trying to understand the beautiful mysteries and interconnections of an ecosystem like that is awe-inspiring.
Yeah.
I mean, so do you find your work as central to that spiritual experience you're talking about?
I think it definitely brings me back down. Like it places my feet on the ground, because most of these things I have researched kind of in a bubble. So I studied philosophy previously, and I studied philosophy of science, and I learned a lot of physics through reading Einstein or other theories, and then I studied physics, but seeing it itself, right? Seeing it in nature, having a daily experience where you just happen to see something really simple, like a bucket on a boat, where like the water at the very top of the bucket just makes a pattern because of how it is hitting the boat. You know, like simple concepts of physics that just show up in daily life, like how you look at water and it kind of makes these really intricate shapes and patterns. And it's like, wow, that's math, that's mathematics, that's chaos theory. And for some reason, that just makes me awestruck. And I know I don't understand it all, but that's part of the magic.
Yeah. Lauren, you are clearly an inspiring seeker, for sure. I'm reverberating with you right now here. What's interesting to me is you're describing that that wonder in the actual work that you're doing, you know, just everything from seeing the ripples of water on the surface of a bucket in your boat to doing those dives or doing a work that could benefit the community. As you've been hearing, Professor Chen has been talking about companies becoming a kind of church. I don't know if you're working for a specific company or group right now at the same time that you're doing your studies, but do you feel like there's some sort of belief that you have in the company that you're working for too?
I definitely have to agree with that. There are groups that come together to collaborate as part of my job. Different organizations come together to achieve a general goal of understanding these ecosystems further, of explaining it to the public, but also helping engineering projects be more wholesome in that sense. And I think there's definitely a specific purpose that scientists have, which is you're trying to better the world in some sense. You're trying to make discoveries, but hopefully the discoveries will be attained and will be useful to society.
Yeah. Well, Lauren Padron is a mechanical engineer and a student at Florida International University as well, speaking to us from Miami, Florida today. Lauren, it's been a great pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Professor Chen, respond to what you hear from Lauren, not Silicon Valley, but there's still the sense that she is getting a kind of a deeply important fulfillment from the work she's doing.
Yeah, and what a just beautiful and inspiring her observations. I could tell she has a very she's spiritually very sensitive, and just has a very beautiful spirit inside her. Mm-hmm. You know, just consciousness and of wonder and awe, and I think that. You know, what she describes and many of the callers described is this how work is an important way that we connect ourselves to the community, that
yes.
we make ourselves, that we contribute to the community and that we find meaning in the world. And again, I don't want to suggest that work isn't that or work shouldn't be that. I think that, you know, what I'm trying to focus on instead is rather how this becomes cultivated and how it becomes, in a way, manipulated by these tech companies. Mm. So that, you know, when I argue that work is replacing religion, I'm not only arguing that it's becoming a source of identity, belonging, purpose for employees, but it's also now become the institution that provides for spiritual care and that companies have very strategically harnessed spirituality in order to make their workers more productive. So, for instance, they offer meditation and mindfulness classes. Most senior leaders get executive coaching, and I spent a lot of time with executive coaches. I went to their training sessions. I interviewed them, and many of them bring in spiritual practices to help senior leaders align the deepest parts of themselves with their work so that they start to, you know, essentially see their mission and purpose defined through their labor. These companies specifically use a language of calling and mission and, you know, ethos, in a way borrowing much of the language and practices and culture of these organizations such as family and religion that have no bounds in our devotion. See, so what I'm talking about is sort of the manufacturing, really, of purpose and fulfillment in the workplace.
Oh no, I completely understand that, and it's almost like a two-way street in some professions, right? Because it's not only the corporation that's shaping or manufacturing, as you're saying, this experience, but I think workers expect something like that too, right? It's an expectation they have. Go ahead. Yeah.
Yes, I think that's exactly right. And I think that this is a product also of the last 4 years as we've seen the decline in civic institutions, as we've seen the decline in, you know, belonging to these other communities. The thing is, when you think about how we find meaning and purpose, this is not something we ever do in isolation. We don't do this in isolation. It's not just a personal thing. We find meaning and purpose in life through the communities and institutions that we belong to. So this is where when I talk about the theocracy of work, we have to think about the larger sort of the ecosystem of meaning, really. Mm-hmm. Or the economy of meaning, you might want to think about it in this way. You know, what are the institutions, what are the organizations that are giving society meaning, that are giving people meaning, that people, that will give people identity and belonging, that people are willing to sacrifice and submit to? And increasingly, this institution is the workplace. Yeah.
Well, let me just get one more quick voice in here.
Sure.
This is a software engineer named Kevin Chu, and he works in Silicon Valley. He's also an evangelical Christian, and here's some of what he told us.
I think a lot of what's driving the secularization of the faith experience is that people don't want to deal with the messiness of traditional religion. They don't want to deal with the baggage of a traditional godhead or religious figure. So instead of worshiping a central traditional Judeo-Christian god, it becomes a bit more abstract in the sense of pursuing success or pursuing an enlightened way of doing things in tech.
That's Kevin Chu, a Silicon Valley software engineer. Now, Professor Chen, we've got just a few minutes left here, and I keep coming back. Look, full disclosure, as a journalist, I am in a mission-driven industry, right? Journalists love to pat themselves on the back for being, you know, world changers and speaking truth to power and being mission-driven, et cetera, et cetera. So a lot of this is actually resonating quite powerfully in me because I keep thinking, well, if not finding purpose in work, then where? But isn't that the question, right? Shouldn't we all be asking ourselves, what do we have outside of the walls of our employment? And how can we build and find a connection in the community at large, whether it's through a church or not, that may have a greater impact and form more durable bonds than can ever be truly possible in the place of work?
Yes, I think that's a great point that you raise. So I found there were two groups of people who didn't worship work. This was older workers and then also workers who were religious. And in both groups, what I found is that they didn't worship work. Their lives didn't revolve around work because essentially they were involved in organizations or communities outside of the workplace that claim their time and devotion and energy. And so instead, they found their sense of belonging and purpose in these organizations outside of work instead of the workplace. So, you know, when this question of how do we stop worshiping work, I go back to this quote from the late writer and poet David Foster Wallace. He says, there are no such thing as atheists. We all worship something. The only thing is that we get to choose what we worship. And I think that in these knowledge industry hubs like Silicon Valley, if you live in a society like that, by default, you will worship work because that's the way that society is organized, so that all the material, social, and spiritual benefits of society are concentrated in the workplace. And that's why people are attracted to it. This is why they work so hard. This is why they are, you know, they experience an existential crisis if they withdraw from that. So the question then is not about, you know, setting your priorities, as, you know, many time management gurus would say, or work-life balance folks would say. It's not about me making an individual decision to set my priorities, but how do we as a society create these institutions outside of work that can lay claim to our time and devotion?
Well, the book is Work, Pray, Code: When Work Becomes Religion in Silicon Valley. We have an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org, and it is truly a fascinating read. Professor Carolyn Chen, thank you so much for the book, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Meghna. I was so happy to be here with you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.